Thank you very much, Mark, for your very great talk. Before we move on to the next speaker, I just wanted to make two quick little reminders. If you have anything that might ring or beep or make any other kind of noise, please turn it on to vibrate. And again, if you have questions for the benefit of everyone else in the room and for the purposes of videotaping, please just step up to the mic. So next, we have Dr. Carl Looper, who will be speaking to us about depression and its differential diagnosis. Dr. Looper is a psychiatrist who works at the Jewish General Hospital and collaborates regularly with the palliative care team, for which we are very, very grateful. And he is also the director of the psychiatry postgraduate residency program at McGill, and we're very, very happy to have him with us.
All right. Well, thank you, Bessie, for that introduction and also for inviting me to present here today. It's always impressive to see such a large number of people interested in the same thing that I'm interested in, not always the case. So I work at the Siegel Cancer Center, and I consult to the inpatient wards of the hospital, medical, surgical. I have a clinic in the oncology department, and also I consult to the palliative care. I have no particular conflicts of interest to declare regarding this presentation. What I want to talk about today is depression and its differential diagnosis. And I think the first differential of depression is not depressed, right? It's normal distress. So one key issue is how do we distinguish between what you would consider a natural response to illness and what you would consider a depression really needing a focused treatment. Next, I want to talk a bit about the overlap between medical and mental health, and in particular, mind-body physiology, because in recent years, we're increasingly identifying the physiological pathways by which people who become ill medically or physically may be at high risk of developing depression. In the palliative care setting and in the severely ill medical patients, there are a number of treatment interventions that might directly cause depression, and so I want to review that. And then what we see quite often in the palliative care setting is delirium. So it's important to really distinguish again what is the difference between depressed and delirium. I'll finish with a few principles of treatment and some particular considerations I want to bring up regarding that. So I think, this is the stages of illness, reaction to illness that you're all very familiar with, and that generate a lot of distress. In of itself, it's not necessarily something that is unhealthy, or something that has to be managed, but we need to identify at what point does the reaction to an illness or a stage of illness become maladaptive and really need to be focused on as far as a treatment goes. So just one example, and there would be one for every stage of illness that you can imagine, but denial, for example. This is a really self-protective mechanism. People use denial in a healthy way to allow them to cope with something that is overwhelming, and it's sort of a defense, allowing them to get through something to and then be able, at a later point, to come back and deal with it. Level of denial is fairly high, ranging from denial of cancer itself, which is found in about a third of patients who are in an oncology setting, denial of the impact of cancer. So yes, I have cancer, but really that's not my problem. My problem is X, Y, and Z. And then finally, denial of emotions, acknowledging the situation in a full range, but possibly not acknowledging their own reaction to it. So as I say, it can be protective, and it can be beneficial if it allows the person to avoid anxiety, allows them to cope better. It can be maladaptive if it leads, for example, to avoiding treatment. So this is one distinguishing feature. You have to identify a little bit what stage the person is at, you know, what they have to deal with, and whether their coping mechanism at that time or their coping style is adaptive or it's interfering. You know, other natural sort of expressions of distress are sort of the search for an explanation. A lot of people go through this phase of asking, why me? Why is it that I ended up with this illness? Other forms are positive thinking, which can be, as I say, positive. It may help someone cope, but it can be to the point of not allowing themselves or anyone around them to acknowledge negative feelings. So that's something that requires a bit of discussion and possibly, you know, as your role as the clinician, maybe bringing out those aspects that the person is not able to acknowledge on their own. Finally, and throughout, there's a need to preserve hope. Dr. Hamel mentioned that there are different ways of presenting hope. So hope, you know, from my point of view and particularly in palliative care, it's not necessarily a cure. Hope is that they have good treatment, that they have good support, that they're able to express themselves and plan for the remainder of their life. People going through illness, you know, have a lot of reasons to become depressed. So quite often it's their treatments. There are surgeries that cause pain, disfigurement, body image issues, radiation as well that cause burning, skin changes, chemotherapy causing hair loss, nausea, all kinds of very disruptive sort of physical reactions. And some of the most commonly reported sort of responses and fears are regarding the pain that someone might suffer, other physical symptoms like nausea, and really just their identity as a person as it's manifested through their body image issues. It's a time of great personal loss, not only in your physical health, but in your social roles. People are losing their employment, or even if they're not losing their job itself, they might be in a stage of disability. They're no longer able to fulfill that role and feel that kind of, you know, positive presence in their life. Their social role, they tend to lose their, you know, social contacts, certain relationships. Time, you see a lot of people who are already, when they're ill and even considering the possibility of not making it through, imagining all the things that they're going to miss in the years that they will not be living. Financial status is a big issue and a big stress on patients. And, of course, just their plans that they would have made for the future. Some patients are very lucky to have solid social support, and others really very unfortunate. It's not unusual. Even someone who comes, who appears to have, you know, a family, that they're married, that they're you have a good social background, often you find that their friends are suddenly uncomfortable being in their presence. Marriages, it's a high rate of dissolution of marriages during a major medical illness. And even family members may not be present in the way the patient is expecting. There are survivorship issues, the people who come through it, and there are challenges to sort of readjust to life in spite of ongoing disability, having people think that, you know, they're now perfectly fine, that that's behind them, and everyone would prefer not to, you know, dwell on it, but it remains a very key issue for the patient. And then, of course, there are palliative care issues, which are, you know, very prominent, a loss of autonomy, preserving dignity, just accepting the progression of illness, taking appropriate action to prepare for the end of life, informing family and friends, existential issues. So at some point along this trajectory, people begin to unravel. And this is, again, this issue of how do we distinguish between what you might attribute to a natural kind of stress response and what actually turns into something that you would identify as a depression. So people who are at risk of depression would have a may have a past history. So in assessing this, you would look for people who have been treated in the past, have required psychological support, family history of depression, previous health problems, and then a lot, and then social stresses like financial concerns, drug or alcohol problems, and low family support. As I mentioned just in the introductory slide, the past 10 years there's been a greater identification of physiological pathways that link physical health to mental health. And particularly the states of depression that are ongoing, or states of stress that are ongoing, that then may turn into a depressive syndrome. What is seen is that there are a number of physiological systems that are involved in that link. One is the stress response, another is the neuroendocrine system, and finally the immune inflammatory reaction. So I want to mention a little bit about each. So the stress response is something that you've heard of before in various sort of ways, as the fight or flight, fight, flight, or freeze. This is, you know, a very primitive reaction that all animals will have, and it's in response to a threat. And it's a discharge of the sympathetic nervous system that prepares somebody to face a challenge. The central nervous system may perceive a threat, sort of by perceptual, by visual type, or even cognitively. And then this gets translated physiologically through the sympathetic nervous system to the adrenal medulla that releases catecholamines into the bloodstream that goes throughout the body and causes responses at various organs. So what you have as a response is an acceleration of the heart and lung action, an inhibition of the gastrointestinal system, constriction of blood vessels, liberation of nutrients that allows for energy to be present, and acceleration of responses. So you can see that this is that primitive response that allows a person to react to a sudden stress. Less sudden response is the neuroendocrine system, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which regulates a large number of body systems, including digestion, the immune system, mood, emotions, and metabolism. Again, centrally perceived stress is signaled to the pituitary gland that releases ACTH that then releases cortisol from the adrenal cortex. And again, cortisol is a stress hormone that really primes people for maybe a little bit ongoing stressful phase of response. Finally, the third system I want to mention is the immune response. And this is one that actually is receiving more focus. Like in the last decade, there's been a lot of research on pro-inflammatory cytokines that actually comes from the experience with interferon in the setting of oncology, hepatitis C, and in treatment settings. But it's now that that has been identified, it's seen as a very, very early evolutionary function, as it's found in both mammals and birds, and it triggers a sickness response, which is a loss of appetite, sleepiness, social withdrawal, fever, and it begins to resemble a depressive syndrome. So the effects of cytokines might end up producing a type of depression that might not have exactly the mood component, but has many of the physical manifestations of it. So this is what we are left with as far as a mechanism by which people go through a very stressful phase of illness or of life, and that it may lead to a depressive syndrome, probably mediated through at least three physiological systems, the HPA axis, the immune or inflammatory response, and the stress response of the nervous system. These end up having an effect on central neurochemical pathways that are found to be have an important role in depression. So these three are norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine. Now, the evidence of this comes from our treatment of depression, which are the antidepressants that act on these pathways. And I'll get back to that a little bit later in the presentation. But this is probably the end, the common pathway by which stress leads to depression. So how does this manifest clinically? That's sort of the physiology, that's sort of the research behind it, but what's important to us in a clinical setting is how you differentiate between people who are in these phases of distress, they're responding to various stages of illness, and then those who are really developing a depressive syndrome. So we consider normal sadness to be a transient emotional state that may not interfere with their functioning, or if it does, it's not to a serious extent. And clinical diagnoses are really given in the presence of more maladaptive responses or decrease in functioning. Probably the best way clinically to differentiate is really the core mood symptoms. There is the diagnostic criteria of depression includes depressed mood and loss of interest or pleasure. So both, of course, can be present when someone is ill. But when somebody is sick and they cannot respond to any pleasurable type of interaction, for example, they no longer even can enjoy speaking to family members or even take an interest in their pet, something that you would really expect them to maybe respond to, and they have a lack of response, that would probably be the most central kind of feature of depression. The other is that it's persisting, is that it's, you know, really day in, day out, and in a pretty constant fashion. So it's not, again, not reacting to, you know, people coming in the room and asking them how they are, not responding to when they're, you know, there's a meal time, maybe somebody's around to help them eat. And it really interferes with functioning or their adaptation to illness in this situation. Again, you could probably divide the symptoms of depression into those that are more physical and probably are more hard to distinguish from in a patient who is medically ill, and those that are much more psychological or cognitive. So those being a change in mood, decrease in interest and pleasure, worthlessness, and thoughts of death. So even somebody who is going through illness that is quite serious would not necessarily have a sense of worthlessness or guilt. Those would be two other sort of symptoms along with that loss of reactivity that you would identify as being more clearly features of depression. Whereas the physical symptoms are much less reliable. So there's weight changes, disturbed sleep, maybe feeling restless, fatigue, poor concentration. Those are much more general symptoms that you would find in patients who are medically ill. So I think this is a summary slide just to go through sort of more of the indicators of depression. As I mentioned, specific symptoms, severity, and duration. So just in summary here, before we move on, I want to mention that there's, you know, really this need to identify the difference between someone who is stressed, somebody who is depressed, and they're clearly connected because that is what is seen through the physiological type of research that is being done linking these two sort of processes. I would look for these specific mood symptoms, the severity and duration as indicators of depression in need of treatment. So I want to go on to talking a bit about specific mood effects of treatments that you'll find in your patients in palliative care. Also, three that really reflect on those physiological processes that I mentioned earlier. So exogenous corticosteroids have a role to play, much like the endogenous cortisol that is released in a stress response. Interferon is a pro-inflammatory cytokine that has a role in the immune pathway that, again, leads to this type of sickness response. And then hormonal agents, which I hadn't mentioned earlier, but are used in in oncology settings and would have an effect on mood. So corticosteroids, you'll recognize all forms of them taken, you know, by IV, PO, Ventolin, these puffers. And they're in widespread use in many situations, and not just in oncology, but in rheumatological disorders, also just in treating symptoms in the palliative care setting. There's really a very wide range of neuropsychiatric effects. So possibly the most common is depression, but it is certainly not the only one. You know, you see people going on a steroid and eating voraciously, for example, having that appetite stimulation. You also see patients going on steroids. I can think of one in particular who was dying of cancer, went on, you know, a strong dose of steroids, and said she realized she's probably been depressed all her life, and now she's never felt any better. So very striking thing to hear from someone in her medical situation, but having such a strong kind of mood effect. And in that case, I think it was a unique example, but in a very positive, almost euphoric kind of way. The majority of people who go on a steroid, particularly at a certain dose, will have some mood changes. Probably the majority are in the mild to moderate range and in more towards depression. And that happens at about 20 milligrams of prednisone equivalent, and really at higher risk when we would say at 40 milligrams of prednisone equivalent. Interferon. This really was a serendipitous finding that led to a great body of research on physiological links to depression. Interferon is identified as an antiviral, anti-cancer, immunomodulatory agent, and it's used in a variety of settings to treat multiple sclerosis, malignant melanoma, hepatitis C. And so this was just found clinically, that this was entered into clinical use, and they found that almost the majority of patients were becoming depressed or depressive. So maybe not exactly that same kind of major depression that you see in psychiatry, but some form of depressive response. And so 10 years later and tons of, you know, basic type of research, they identify that interferon stimulates the release of cytokines, which is producing this behavioral response that we refer to as the sickness response or sickness behavior. It's found in about 25 to 50% of patients who begin interferon, and it usually occurs in the first months. It's found to respond very well to antidepressants. So that is something to keep in mind. Finally, I want to mention other agents that might have very direct mood effects. So you see a lot of patients on various types of hormonal treatments, you know, and we know that there is a link between hormonal changes and depression. So it's seen in, you know, in the lifespan, as in premenstrual dysphoria, postpartum depression, and menopausal depression. And it really, there's some link, although not very clear in the sense of affecting all people in the same way, but there seems to be a link between a drop in estrogen and the presence of mood changes. So here we have a number of examples, certainly tamoxifen being in widespread use, aromatase inhibitors, and in men, antiandrogens, all of which can precipitate a type of mood change that, again, is depressive in its general tendency. The kind of depression that you have with these medications is, as I mentioned, it's not necessarily that profound mood change in terms of being sad, depressed, and tearful. I've called this a typically atypical presentation. So it's more characterized by apathy, loss of energy. The mood might be irritable as opposed to depressed. And a kind of behavioral agitation might be present, particularly with the use of corticosteroids. So your treatment approach also has to be modified, although in many settings antidepressants are, you know, it's still the recommended approach. You might even be using benzodiazepines, or certainly for corticosteroid-induced mood changes might improve with the use of an antipsychotic medication. So I thought this was the best slide to represent delirium. So it's, you know, sort of your brain malfunctioning and needing support. In the palliative care setting, the majority of patients at some point develop delirium. And it can resemble depression because there's a apathetic type of hypoactive delirium where patients are just, they're confused. It's a confusional state, but they're really just sort of not active, they're not responding, they're not speaking, and it can appear very much like depression. So just to, you know, to be a bit more clear about symptoms, delirium is identified as having a fluctuating course, so it's even hard to catch. At times somebody is very lucid, at other times confused. And it might be hard to assess the person who is not responding, not having the self-observing kind of tendencies that they would normally. You may hear about it from family, but you will hear more from family members how lucid they are, how they can remember, you know, very specific things, and that's what families like to report about their loved one. But in fact, you might get more reliable information from the observation of other hospital staff. So many causes of delirium, of course, in the palliative care setting. Medications, I think we're going to hear about that later. How not to make your patient toxic. So that's one of the, you know, number one causes of delirium in the palliative care setting. And then that whole long list of medical causes. Infections are very common, electrolyte imbalances, even really sort of functional type of changes like urinary retention, constipation can cause a delirium. Pain can cause delirium. So you can end up in a very complicated situation of somebody who can be toxic on pain medications and also in great pain, very distracted, and that agitation is leading them, is adding to their confusional state. So delirium actually has its own little differential, which is more than depression, but also dementia. We call it the three Ds, delirium, depression, dementia. And you distinguish them based on the characteristics, usually the longitudinal characteristics, so the temporal pattern. You know, did this predate the hospital visit? Did it have a more clear time of onset, which might reflect a medical change that occurred? Was there a triggering event? You might identify sort of a psychological or psychosocial event that triggered a depression. Of course, the medical history is very important. Psychiatric history might make you think more towards the depression as a possible diagnosis. And just to mention one instrument that I think is very helpful, and particularly in palliative care, the confusion assessment method, the CAM, it has a formula to sort of simplify it for us. As you see at the bottom, delirium equals 1 plus 2 in addition to one of the remaining criteria. So the first is acute onset and fluctuating course. So as I mentioned, that's actually the most reliable way of distinguishing, say, delirium from depression. Inattention is the second, easily distracted, difficulty focusing. And then disorganized thinking is that really that confusion, you know, that comes across as you're talking to a patient. An altered level of consciousness, so falling asleep as you're talking to them, or being, you know, appearing to be half present, half conscious. It's many of our patients are not speaking. Some have trachs, some have laryngectomies, And really the verbal communication is limited. There is a nonverbal assessment approach. It's available online. And so the instructions are to test the attention using, just instructions to, to hold the hand of the patient, ask them to squeeze your hand when you say the letter A. And by doing that, you can test whether they are attending to what you're saying. There are also a set of pictures. Again, you can print out, and you show them the pictures, and then you show them again, another set of pictures, asking them to identify which ones they've seen. So it tests memory, attention, concentration. And then just using yes-no answers to try and assess the disorganized thinking. So going back up, the first is historical, acute onset and fluctuating course. The inattention you might do by this, identifying the letters, identifying the pictures. The third being the disorganized thinking, you can just ask simple questions. Where is the window? Show me the ceiling, this kind of thing. This is the set of laboratory investigations that you might do, and of course, depending on how appropriate it is for the stage of illness. So a lot of patients are not going to be pursuing active treatments, but if you can identify a clear sort of cause of delirium, it's really very helpful to then allow the person to have a greater degree of alertness in the palliative care setting at the end of their life. The approach to treating delirium, of course, is much more broad. The environment, educating, having family members bring in orienting sort of items, things that they will cue their mind. Treating the underlying causes, correcting hydration, and making sure they're fed. It's unfortunate, but it does happen in the hospital that this sort of the hypoactive or confused patient is lying in bed all day. Someone brings in a tray and puts it down and leaves, and the patient is really not attending enough to realize this is their meal. It gets picked up about 1 hour later and taken away, and people go actually without eating. Reducing medications, and then readjusting the treatment of pain. There are not a lot of treatment studies done in delirium, but what has been done is they've identified that antipsychotic medications have greater benefit than benzodiazepine. In particular, sort of the more high potency ones that don't have as much sedation. And in fact, Ritalin is occasionally used, methylphenidate, to improve the alertness, concentration, and attention. Where you have distressing symptoms like paranoia, psychotic symptoms as part of your delirium, then it's really important to use an antipsychotic medication. Where you have someone who is more agitated, you might choose to use a low-potency antipsychotic. One of the atypicals is called quetiapine or Seroquel. That might be the most appropriate choice. Again, you might use this stimulant Ritalin to allow the person to have a greater alertness. Sometimes family members really are wishing to have a bit more time to discuss matters, and it can be used very strategically to allow them to be more present for particular interactions. And then this has to be balanced with the ability to let go and reduce treatment and really adapt to comfort measures. And sometimes applying some sedation as a treatment is the most appropriate. So I want to talk a little bit about treatment. Antidepressants, as I mentioned, work on specific neurotransmitter systems to increase the availability of serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. These are the systems that are found in the brain and are thought to be linked to symptomatic elements of depression, as well as underlying and maintaining the state of depressed mood. So serotonin pathways, norepinephrine pathways, and dopamine, the principles of depression are kind of similar on that pharmacological level. All of these antidepressants that are currently in use are used to increase the presence of neurotransmitters, such as, in this case, serotonin. The most commonly used antidepressants are serotonin reuptake inhibitors. So, sorry, I don't have a pointer, but you can see that there is this reuptake transporter on the presynaptic membrane, and it inhibits the reuptake of the serotonin, making it more available in the synaptic cleft and then more active on the postsynaptic membrane of the next neuron. This is the list of, you know, the currently used antidepressants. The largest group are the serotonergic specific reuptake inhibitors, the SSRIs. You'll recognize many of the names: Celexa, Zoloft, Prozac, Paxil. The SNRIs, serotonergic and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. Venlafaxine is Effexor. Duloxetine is Cymbalta. Oh, thank you. And then we have one dopamine reuptake inhibitor, which is bupropion, or Wellbutrin. And then one which is sort of on a class of its own, which is mirtazapine. The basic principles that some of you will be familiar with is that there's a delayed onset of action. These are medications that, other than side effects, do not work immediately. It may take 2 to 3 weeks to have a benefit to the mood. They should be started and stopped in a gradual fashion, because even stopping an antidepressant can have side effects, and it needs to be tapered. Common side effects are headache, nausea, sedation. Mild side effects really resolve. So the standard advice to patients is what you're experiencing in the first weeks is the side effects of the medication. If they're mild, they'll go away. If they're sort of moderate, they're likely to diminish. So it's a judgment call whether that's worth persisting with. If they're strong, any very pronounced side effect, you can just stop the antidepressant. And it clears the system within a day, and really you should reconsider a different choice. You know, how you choose an antidepressant, it's often based on past response. So patients who have been depressed in the past can tell you how they've responded to whatever agent. Also, there's the profile of effects. So some are more activating, such as Wellbutrin, bupropion, probably the most identified as having a stimulating property. Venlafaxine, Effexor, and fluoxetine, which is Prozac. Others are more sedating, so they can be used in patients who are a little bit agitated or have a lot of insomnia. Mirtazapine, which is Remeron, is very useful. And sertraline, Zoloft, is also commonly recommended for people who are having insomnia. Mirtazapine has some particular use in the medically ill because it stimulates appetite. People often gain weight on Remeron. So I work in two different, very different settings. One, I do a clinic at Concordia University with young students, and I can tell you that trying to get them to take Remeron is a hard sell because among the side effects, they will all know that it causes weight gain. In palliative care, in the oncology clinic, in fact, this is an appealing aspect of that medication. So at once, it sometimes fits very well somebody who's not sleeping and who has lost weight. Citalopram, I would identify as being somewhat neutral, in many respects. It's not activating, it's not sedating, doesn't do a lot to your appetite, so as sort of a standard kind of recommendation. There are a few antidepressants that have a large number of drug interactions, and these are the ones that inhibit the cytochrome P450 2D6 enzyme in the liver and interfere with the metabolism of other drugs. So those are paroxetine, which is Paxil, fluoxetine, which is Prozac, and bupropion, which is Wellbutrin. So those you have to give a little bit of thought to. And if you see a patient who's coming to you on these medications, you should kind of review the other ones that they're on. So I'm going to mention one particular side effect, and this will be the last part of my talk, because it's something that has come up in recent years pertaining to the treatment of depression in cancer patients, and particularly the interaction with tamoxifen. So as you know, tamoxifen is called a SERM. It's a selective estrogen receptor modulator. It's used to treat women who have estrogen receptor positive tumors. It causes a 50% reduction in recurrence of breast cancer and 30% reduction in mortality. So you see that this is considered an essential treatment. Tamoxifen itself, as is the case in a number of other medications, is not actually the most potent. It is the metabolites, 4-hydroxytamoxifen and endoxifen, that are actually the most active in the anti-estrogen effects, as opposed to the first form, which is tamoxifen. So just to give you an idea, 4-hydroxytamoxifen is 100 times more potent, and endoxifen is 5 to 10 times more potent than tamoxifen itself. So in fact, the benefit of it requires the metabolism to these other forms. It's a bit of a complicated story. There are two sort of factors that could interfere with that metabolism. One is that there's a genetic variation in how much people metabolize. And so these are all the different alleles. So you have the genes that will, you know, determine to what extent you can metabolize. And so depending on what gene you have, it could be the usual, the most common amount of metabolism. Metabolism could be increased if you have a certain genetic variant, or it could be decreased, which, of course, in this case would be a big problem because you would be inhibiting the effect of the metabolites. As you see, the tall blue columns are the extensive metabolizers. That's the majority of the population. But you have people who are poor metabolizers. It's a smaller number, but still, there's a certain percent of people who don't metabolize through that one enzyme. So genetically, they're less likely to benefit from tamoxifen. The other problem is what I mentioned about these antidepressants. There are a few that inhibit that enzyme. And what we see is that there have been a number of studies just looking at the effect of using different antidepressants. And so these are these poor metabolizers who really don't metabolize tamoxifen very well. If you're on a potent inhibitor, so this is a few of the antidepressants are potent inhibitors of that enzyme, you may go from usual extensive metabolizer to a poor metabolizer, sort of like this genetic a decreased metabolism. This one identifies venlafaxine as not having the effect. So that's the other important message. You will hear from people that antidepressants interfere with tamoxifen, and it is true for a few of them at least, but you can reassure people that there are safe antidepressants to use in the treatment of depression. I reviewed this carefully with one of the residents who was working with me, Julie Desmarais, and what we found is that these three antidepressants, paroxetine, fluoxetine, and bupropion, probably have a high risk of interfering with metabolism and really should be avoided in people on tamoxifen. On the other end, venlafaxine really has minimal effect. So if you have a patient who is on tamoxifen, then you should select venlafaxine preferentially. The others, this is still being investigated, to what extent the metabolism is interfered with and might be safe or unsafe. Citalopram is a commonly prescribed one, is considered safe, has a very mild effect on the metabolism. Others, sertraline and fluvoxamine, might have a bit more of an effect. So I think I'm going to end, and just to summarize, that there's really a high rate of depression in chronic illness and in palliative care, and really we can see what the physiological pathways are that might lead from one to the other. Clinically, it's important to distinguish between sort of like what is the natural forms of distress and what are the clinical forms of depression that need to be treated. And I would, you know, highlight those key mood symptoms, the duration and the persistence as helping you distinguish. And the treatment of depression really can enhance the goals of palliative care by achieving both symptomatic control and, you know, a better well-being for your patient. I'll end there. And happy to take questions.
I was just curious for your treatment of depression. I know that I've been using Ritalin at times to get a fast response. We see a response within 24 hours, sometimes the same day, and I don't know if your experience or your ideas on the use of Ritalin for just depression, not necessarily hypoactive delirium.
Yeah. So I think, especially in palliative care, we have to broaden our scope, because in regular psychiatry, you would not prescribe Ritalin to treat depression. But certainly in palliative care, we're looking symptomatically at symptom control. And so your suggestion of Ritalin is often recommended. Also, a stimulating antidepressant, like this Wellbutrin, for example, bupropion, would be appropriate. And then there's the other sort of end of that spectrum, which is patients who are a bit agitated and in their depression. And then you might use, in addition to an antidepressant, you might use a benzodiazepine or maybe a calming type of atypical antipsychotic. So I think I would agree with you that we need to broaden the scope of what we use.
Thank you very much for the talk. I just wonder if there's any study that have compared in terms of the use of medication versus supportive therapies for palliative patients, just like for the general population, and also the availability of this kind of therapy for palliation.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a big issue. You know, the recommendation really is more to, you know, as a first line, you know, to consider a psychological approach. And in fact, even before that, I would back up and say to look at environmental, behavioral, sort of wellness type of approaches. So really, I tell people about exercise, you know, talk about nutrition, their sleep habits. These are things that really, even before going to a clinical treatment, can be helpful. Next, as you're saying, there are studies that have looked at comparing, you know, antidepressants to psychotherapy, and, you know, most confirm that both are effective. And particularly, I would also say they're not mutually exclusive. So you might really be recommending both for people who are more moderately to severely depressed. Certainly patients who are in the more mild range are the more suitable candidates for, you know, to start with psychotherapy alone. And then what you mentioned of the availability is actually the biggest problem. And, you know, fortunately, palliative care, there's such a focus on, just a comprehensive approach. It's a little bit more available in that setting. Unfortunately, in general, psychotherapy is less available.
You had mentioned that, you know, the mood symptoms are more specific and more important because the other symptoms of depression, which are more physical, are less specific. Does that mean we increase the threshold to say it's depression, or does it not matter whether the physical symptoms are coming from the disease or depression? Would they benefit to the same extent, and would we count them as criteria that go under the diagnosis?
Thanks for the question. I think it's the approach that is different. Because, you know, especially in palliative care, what the patient is presenting with, all of it is important. I wouldn't say to discount sort of like the more physical symptoms. But with the patients that are more in that sort of category, you would think more towards, you know, that their depression might be secondary to medical problems, to particular treatments, drug effects. And you might think more naturally towards really symptomatic treatment, as opposed to the concept in the other group, which you would identify as being more clearly having a major depression, and you would really probably consider an antidepressant more as a first line, as opposed to the symptomatic approach model.
When you talk about the use of Ritalin, do you use it more as a co-medication along with an antidepressant, or do you use it on its own?
Well, you know, there's a time frame issue, which was brought up, and it's true. You know, the effect you have with Ritalin is what you get within hours, whereas what you have with an antidepressant, you know, you're talking about weeks. So, you can start an antidepressant, and realize then that you may not have the time frame. So I think there are patients really at end of life where Ritalin is a better choice. And as far as co-treatment goes, again, I think it's what target that you're aiming. So for patients who are really drowsy, really sedated, they might be on a lot of pain medication that causes them to be sedated. Might benefit greatly from being on Ritalin. And it has mood effects. When antidepressants were much less available, Ritalin and other stimulants were used as antidepressants. Mm-hmm. So really there is a history of stimulants as an antidepressant.
Thanks.
You touched on gradual starting and gradual withdrawal, so going to this sort of weeks of life left where someone's been on Effexor for months or years, and now they're NPO, but they still have weeks to live. Can you review a little bit of how we should withdraw or what we should put them on, or if there's other things we can use better where they won't have withdrawal symptoms closer to that time period if we see it coming?
Yeah. So I didn't go into that in detail, but this is something, a phenomenon that was observed a little bit late. You know, all these newer antidepressants were in very widespread use before anyone really acknowledged that there was a problem with discontinuation. So now, it's widely understood that there is a discontinuation syndrome, which is a kind of restlessness and agitation. There are neuropsychological symptoms like visual changes, dizziness, just feeling unwell. And that's what you can get. And, you gave the example of venlafaxine. There are some antidepressants that do that more, and venlafaxine is one of them. It's a fairly potent antidepressant with a shorter half-life, so you actually have that as a more likely problem. So, we have this all the time in the hospital because palliative care is one setting. Surgeries. People come in for a surgery, all their medications stop when they go into the OR, and they might not start up again for a number of days. Probably this is a factor that leads to an increased rate of delirium in hospitals, like just in general. NPO is an issue. There are certain medications that can be crushed and others not. So Wellbutrin, Effexor, these are capsules, and so they're not meant to be opened and put in feeding tubes, which you can do, except that, in fact, they clog up the feeding tubes. So it ends up being impractical. Having said that, depending on what stage you're at, you can treat the symptoms that arise. So this is a person who's hospitalized. They're monitored every day. If it so happens that you've observed for no choice you've had to stop this antidepressant, and they're becoming restless, then you can treat it again, probably with a benzodiazepine, with a very low dose of antipsychotic medication if it's in the context of a larger amplitude of agitation. The other thing you might do is change their antidepressant. So you could change it to a medication that can be crushed and fed if they're still having a feeding tube.
I have a couple of questions with respect to delirium. I noticed in your delirium workup that you looked for B12 and magnesium, and I was wondering if that was part of a delirium workup versus trying to rule out whether there's some kind of reversible dementia or something.
You're right. Yeah, it's more that's more included in a dementia type of workup. Vitamin B12 especially is one that is a reversible, so-called reversible dementia, but it produces cognitive symptoms. Even in the borderline range, like the B12 level that is considered to be deficient, you know, in our hospital lab is 140, let's say. But even people who are, 200, in the low 200s, would benefit from B12 supplementation.
Okay. And same thing for magnesium?
Yeah, same thing for magnesium.
Okay. And then I'm curious, if you think that somebody who is in urinary retention or constipated can actually develop confusion, or is it just increased agitation on top of their baseline delirium?
I can't be very specific, but I think, it's one component. Delirium is rarely, one cause. It's usually multifactorial, as you know. So I think it's something that would add. That alone in a healthy person obviously would not. But in an elderly person who might already have some cognitive deficit, who is disoriented by coming into the hospital, in addition is in great discomfort, it might.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure.
Thank you very much. That was a great talk. That was a very important